Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Home in on end-of-season savings on bedding, curtains, wallpapers and more. In-store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannon with you until 3 o'clock today. And if you were tuned into us yesterday, you will have heard really the change in mood in the country and patients really beginning to fray over the issue of the response to Storm Éowyn. Because, you know, while the rest of us, some of us up here have been getting out our lives and have had dealing with no impact at all, the lives of many of our listeners have been so severely impacted. And the calls are still coming. There are still many tens of thousands out there in very difficult situations. Ross, good afternoon to you.
How are you, Katie? How's things? Thanks for taking my call.
And I was just saying there, a lot of us in Dublin have no sense of this at all, but you actually are in Dublin.
I am, yeah. I'm in Dublin. I'm just at the back of Dublin Airport. And we have been without power since 3:40 on Friday morning.
And who have you got in the house with you there, Ross?
I live with my brother there in the house.
And he has health issues, I understand.
He has, yeah. He's on a breathing machine at night, so it requires power, obviously, to run for the whole night. The machine is connected to the power all night long. So
what happened on Thursday night then? When the power
Thursday
went
night
out?
We had power till 3:40, so obviously we had to do without the machine. We've no option. But since then, we've been checked into hotels. But again, we're onto the ESB every day. We're not listed online as a fault. So we've just to constantly keep on ringing. But they give you just an estimated time. Now, we were told there was a chap out with us from the ESB on Saturday, and he'd done a risk assessment and the whole lot. Now, you'd understand that if we were in the middle of nowhere, if it was a major issue. But the line is still actually standing, and it's only one strand that is tore on the line. So according to the chap even that was out on Saturday, it's a simple fix. If they could get the power up and running, is what I'm asking. If they can come out and do a temporary fix, and in 2 months' time or in 6 months' time, when everything quiets down, if they tell you we have to switch the power off for a day or 2 days to replace the line, we'd be happy enough with that. But it's just to get the power back on is what we're looking for.
And how many houses are affected, do you know?
It's just myself and one of my neighbours on the road affected.
Oh, yeah, you see, you guys. Given the pressure that they're under, you can imagine how they are rationing their manpower to some degree, maybe, and you're not getting the priority that you need.
I'd understand that, all right, yeah. But you'd understand maybe 2 days or three days without power, but when we're going into nearly 5 days now without power.
And what do they say to you when you call? Yeah, what's the response when you call?
The response is that the power, well, we were promised on Monday that the power would be back on by Tuesday at 12 noon, which it obviously wasn't. When we rang then on Tuesday, we were told that chap shouldn't have made the stop promise, that all they can do is give an estimated time. So their estimated time then goes from the 27th at 9 o'clock to the 28th at 9 o'clock, and now it's gone to the 31st at 9 o'clock.
And in the meantime,
and that's 9 o'clock at night. So, like, you and I both know that the ESB lads are not out at 9 o'clock at night fixing ESB lines.
Well, I think they might be at the moment, actually, to be honest with you, Ross. But well, in normal circumstances,
they would be, but either that's neither here nor there. My issue would be, like, my issue is not with the lads on the ground. It seems to be down to poor management, and there's nobody in the government to stand up and be held responsible for this. Like, how long more is this to go on? How long more have we to book into hotels? And it's not even booking into hotels the issue. It's not known whether you're in a hotel tonight or you're going home, or whether you have to whether you're going to get a hotel tonight if you leave it too long.
So, yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Like, have you got an open booking there, or do you have to book day by day?
No, so just every day we're booking day by day, packing your stuff up, leaving, hoping that we're going home. And then when it comes to that even, you're not going home.
So you're using the hotel as a base for the night time, basically.
Using the hotel for a base, yeah. And the people in the ESB, like the last person I spoke to in the ESB, they told me, I said to him, like, what are we meant to do? Can you just give us an update? And he told me to grin and bear it and just do what everybody else is doing with no power.
That's not That's not what you want to be hearing. I know. I do have some sympathy for, as I was saying, of the lads out on you know, who are out fixing wires and who are out fixing poles. And I know that they're probably demented from people asking them and demanding to know. But that's you know, you still have to understand that people are in a very bad situation now, and they need to get good information. Have you been at home since? Like, have you been? Do you go home for the afternoons?
Yeah. I'm at home every day, hoping that when I drive down the road, that I'm going to see the ESB in the middle of the road fixing the cable. But every day I drive down, and there's nobody there.
And did you have all the things that people talk about? A freezer full of food.
Yeah, almost €300 worth of food in the fridge and the freezer, which I obviously went and done my shop on Thursday night, thinking that the weather was going to be bad and that we just get a few bits in, because people were going mad in shops as well, and there was no bread and there was no basic essentials basically in the shops, and we done all that, but then sure, the food had to be thrown in the bin.
I would say the amount of food that was bought on Thursday that never made it to Sunday because exactly that there was a kind of a slight panic out there, we better get some stuff in, and it never occurred to us, of course, that if the power goes, the food goes, a lot of the food goes as well. What is the very latest you've been given? Is it the 29th? Or today is the what? The 29th. So what was the last date you were given?
So we're pushed out now to the 31st at 9 p.m. at night.
Okay, so you have another two days, possibly.
The thing that I don't understand is, like, the ESB have to still have emergency lads in Dublin. I know I'm not the only one without power, but a simple fix, I'd understand if a pole came down or if a tree came down and broke the cable and knocked the cable to the ground or whatever. But it's this pole, the poles are still erected, the cable's still in place. It's just one strand, like it's 3 inches of a strand of cable that's broke away. So like, how they can't repair it? Like, in my eyes, it'd take 20 minutes to repair.
Yeah, it's very frustrating, all right. Ross, listen, I'll let you go. Thanks for that, and the very best of luck, and I hope you meet an ESB man on your road sooner rather than later. That's Ross there, just a few minutes away from Dublin Airport. You know, when we say people in Dublin don't know what's going on, there are a few pockets in Dublin that have been badly hit as well. Helen, good afternoon, Helen.
Hello, Katie.
Yeah, Helen, we were talking to Ross there about his freezer contents, €300 worth of food in the bin. You had the same problem.
I did indeed. I also had my husband's 70th birthday coinciding on Friday, so I had done a really big shop. And as you say, none of it got cooked. But anyway, mine is just really a minor gripe. Mm-hmm. Listening to people, I know fridges and freezers probably are very small things to be giving out about. We were out of power, and we also had a tree down in the back garden. So we looked at our household insurance, and we could clearly see that it said they wouldn't cover the tree. But there, in lovely black and white, it told us that they covered loss of damage to freezer or refrigerator contents following loss of power, up to €650.
Okay, so you're delighted with yourself.
Absolutely. A chink of light in every cloud.
Indeed.
So we gave a phone call, actually, it's a broker we deal with. And we definitely weren't the first person ringing him that day, because he had everything we needed to know on the tip of his tongue. So basically, we were told, yes, we did have cover. No, the first 250 excess was ours. Okay. And every single item that we would be claiming for from the fridge, and I have a really big freezer, had to be itemised and have a receipt for the good.
Right.
And I don't know that I'd like to say on air how old some of the stuff in my freezer is.
I literally was going to say I wouldn't like to be acknowledging the age profile of some of the contents in my freezer right now.
Well, same here. Yeah, housewife of the year I'm not. But just the very idea that you're going to have to produce a receipt, it's so obviously to put you off making a claim. And so when we of course said, well, we obviously don't have receipts, they said, oh, well, there is a way around it. If you have a product and you know you bought it in Dunnes and you go in and you can find the same product, you can photograph the price and put it with the picture in your claim form. So, okay, I suppose that's one way around it. But
what's to stop you, though, Helen? Sorry, what's to stop you just going in and photographing lots of expensive frozen food, deciding that you had a fierce addiction to prawns and lobster, and that's what your freezer was full of.
Steak, yeah. Exactly. I said to the hubby there, this isn't a very good way of determining that you don't cheat, you know, because as you say, you could really go in and do a really big shop of really nice stuff and say that was in your freezer. So it really, if it's to counteract the idea of somebody being dishonest, it doesn't work very well. So I can only take it that the reason the insurance company wants you to do that is to put you off. I haven't done my freezer, Katie. Mm-hmm. I did my fridge yesterday, and there's 41 different items in it that I would be claiming and I would have to go and get prices for. Now,
that's a full-time job in itself.
Yeah, like who on earth has time really to do that? And then when I send them my photo of my horseradish sauce, which is one third gone, where do we go then, Katie?
Oh, God.
I think we're into databases and spreadsheets.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It just strikes me that if an insurance company is going to offer you something like this, it might be better just to put, we'll give you €100. And have it nice and up front. And if I have 650's worth after my 250 excess, then I take the rap, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, minor gripe.
Helen, indeed, yeah. And as you say, you acknowledged there at the start that there are people in much worse issues out of it. But it is an issue that a lot of people around the country are wondering, you know, will they be able to get anything back? For their freezer contents, and good to know that that's what might be waiting for them when they make that call.
I'd be very interested to see whether other people are having better experiences in claiming off their insurer.
Helen, thanks for that and best of luck. And have you got your power back now, Helen?
Oh, we're so lucky. We came back on Monday night. We'd actually gone up to Dublin because we were so cold here and stayed with relatives and had been hoping to have it back on Tuesday evening. And then when we were coming up the road, we got a text saying it would be the 2nd of February. And would have U-turned except that we had a Home Alone cat who required looking after. And we arrived home freezing cold, and literally half an hour later the power came on. So we are very lucky.
That was your husband's 70th birthday present, wasn't it?
Oh, boy, yeah.
a few days late.
There wasn't anything else he wanted near as much, that's for sure.
That's for sure. Helen, thanks so much for that. Good to talk to you. Rebecca, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie, hi.
Where are you based there, Rebecca?
I'm in East Knockbride in County Cavan.
And what's your situation there now?
So we still have currently no power here in Knockbride. It's hard times.
I know, and I'm making light of it. And I'm so conscious that there's a lot of people who have no sense of humour left about this whatsoever.
Because I
do understand that it's no fun at all if you're in the middle of this. And you have three kids,
Rebecca. Three kids. One's 11, 9, and 6.
And what are they telling you about when you might get your power back?
So this morning we got a message in saying that it would be the 6th of February. And then this afternoon we got a message. I actually got an SMS off ESB saying that it was restored, but it's actually not.
Oh.
And we relogged the fault. So... I don't quite know when the power will be back here. I don't think ESB really know either. I did hear it got up as far as maybe 4 miles away, and there's probably faults between there and our house, yeah. So that's where we are.
And how,
it's a bit unknown.
Yeah, and it is the unknown is what kills you as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
How are you managing?
Well, we're struggling along, I suppose. We're, you know, it's very hard to be at home, but we're trying to, in the afternoons, to when I come home from work, to go to friends' houses that have a bit of power or have a generator. But as for home here, you know, any washing that's done is, we're collecting rainwater to heat up to wash the dishes and, you know, boiling kettles for hot water bottles, but for a bit of heat. But the house is very cold got now. At this stage, last night and the night before was quite cold. You'd be waking with the cold in the bed.
And
our fridge, yeah, you know, missing the fridge is a big deal as well, because you're not really getting anything substantial to eat then, you know.
Yeah, and we were talking to Helen there about the her contents of her freezer going. But something that is another point, and again, I'm really conscious that it's the time of year, people maybe their bank accounts aren't that flush after Christmas.
That's
there's
right.
a lot of bills
That's
after
right.
coming in and landing.
Yeah.
And it's towards the end of the month as well. So you're, you know, maybe waiting for
right.
a paycheck to drop.
Yeah.
And then you're having to buy food in a way that is the most expensive way you could possibly buy food, especially if
buy
you've
it.
Got three kids.
Yes. Like if you go into a, you know, if you're going to a bar for food, you know, you're spending €60 at least for a meal. We try and go to delis and that, but that's a lot of money too, you know. And my husband works from home, and you know, he's going to be potentially without any work for 2 weeks, you know. And it's just it's hard to, you know, the money is tight after Christmas, as you say, like, you know. So it's very hard. And yeah, only for our community, you know, all friends and neighbours banding together and helping each other out, which is great, you know. But we could be in it for the long haul too, you know. It's just, it's hard to know.
That's the thing, isn't it? You can kind of put up with almost anything when you see the end in sight. But
it's
just the unknowing part of it.
Yeah. And you know, we have no TV, and you have to listen to the radio in the car. And really, we have had no official, you know, anybody telling us what really is going on. We don't know. You know, you hear rumours. You know. You know, it could be a long time, and you just don't know, because we can't watch the news and we can't listen to the radio only when you're in the car and that sort of thing. So it's hard to know.
Yeah, and you feel cut off, obviously.
Yes. You know.
How are the kids managing? I mean, are they learning all new kinds of card games and board games? And
they are. Yeah, indeed. We have the draughts board out plenty, and the Uno cards aren't too suitable for around a candle flame. We can't really see the colours, but yeah. we're trying to make the best of it, you know, lots of arts and crafts and that sort of thing, and trying to visit friends and stuff like that, you know, and keep them busy. And yeah, that's it, you know.
Yeah, I'm thinking a lot of children now are getting a little taste of a 1970s childhood in Ireland.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. I know. And school is right. It's just over the road from us. So, you know, it is going to be shut for the duration of this as well, which is a long stint too, you know, for anybody that has other work commitments and stuff like that. You know, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Rebecca, good luck is all I can say to you. Best of luck there.
And
I hope it comes back sooner rather than later for you there. That's Rebecca there in Cavan. Frank, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Frank, you're down the west of Ireland.
Yeah, down in the west, I suppose that's how we feel, right? You know, down, very down at the moment. can I just say too something just in response to the people that were listening to there in relation to the ESB? There's a neighbour of mine, he's a dairy farmer, his cows are calving. The ESB crew came to him today and they're basically walking the lines or whatever, and they said, we need to replace three poles on your land. These weren't knocked by trees, no, they're just rotten or whatever due to lack of maintenance. But he says, we had no poles and we had no machinery to replace them. And he said, when might I have? And he said, at the best, he said, the 5th of February. Right? So these men are out 24/7, and he said, we don't have poles. We're actually short of poles, and we're short of machinery to replace the poles, and the poles are replaced. We can't progress the lines. So he said we can't give you any other information other than that. So that's an interesting one.
It
so
is,
it seems
they,
to me to suggest a lack of maintenance, isn't it? Yeah.
So a lack of poles. I got it. It's the first I heard of that one now.
What he said, yeah.
Come back to me, your own situation, that you're a dry stock farmer yourself there.
Yeah, dry stock farmer, yeah, probably at the end of my dry stock days. And in 1991, I kind of recognised the fact that I wasn't going to be in a position with my farm to, build a house, raise a family. So I decided to plant a portion of the land in forestry. And I got a grant at that stage to plant it, and I did plant it. The way it works is you get a grant to plant, and I passed over the grant to a forestry company. Mm-hmm. They planted my land. You get 75% of the money up front, and then 4 years later, you get the other 25%. So I had to carry that for 4 years. I paid him, and it was established. And it was a good plant. It was, I had left then, and I had gone back to rescale. I'd gone back to further education and rescale myself, and I walked off land. Mm-hmm. So I minded this forestry for that since 1991. Tended twice, which you have to do, basically, to kind of make sure that you end up with quite a good crop.
So what we're talking about 1991, I shouldn't be doing live maths on air, but it's at 34 years.
34, 35, yeah, 34.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, so this is, you would have reared... You would have reared a clatter of children in that time. But anyway, yeah, so you've nursed it to up until...
I'm rusted up to now, so you're minding it, you're looking at your... In the first number of years, you're afraid of fire because it was backing onto some scrubland or rough land or bog. Mm-hmm. And there was a couple of fires that came into there, but it didn't go on fire, was looking at that, so we managed to curtail it. And then it gets to a stage where it's, 15, 20 years and it's safe enough, it's just grown. And then you're worried about fire, you're worried about wind and whatever. But I tended twice. I tended 3-4 years ago. And then the next, I suppose, treatment was to clear fell it.
As in, it's mature enough and you cash it in, basically.
Yeah, you cash it in, such as it is. Now, when I planted this, I'd be a bit sore about this. When I planted it, it was tax-free, supposedly. But then when the crash came, the government imposed PRSI and social charge or whatever on your profits. Mm-hmm. So you keep it for that length of time, you mind it, and you take all the responsibility and all the risk. And now I've applied for planning or permission or a license to tenant to clear fell it, and that was going to happen this year.
Okay, and this is for your pension, basically. This was an investment into your retirement years, kind of thing.
Absolutely, yeah. And it was an investment for myself and my wife, whatever. In our declining years, a bit of financial security. And you'd also hope that maybe you'd have something to leave for your children, when you'd go, that you might leave something to them afterwards.
Okay, so how did it survive Storm Éowyn?
This might sound strange to you. Like, this is obviously just a financial loss, but it's emotional as well and psychological loss. Because I actually quite liked walking through the trees. It's a nice thing to walk through a forest, to have a forest. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of the crop, and it was ready to be harvested. And the strange thing, Casey, I probably could have harvested a couple of years ago, but I thought there might be some scheme, These forests are carbon sinks, so if you can keep them there, in the world we live in, they're taking their carbon or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had the notion that maybe there would be a plan or there'd be some scheme that would maybe pay you a compensation just to leave it there. Uh-huh. Let it keep growing or whatever. So, of course, that never happened in my naivety. But I suppose the two things in relation to it happened now, it was an extraordinary wind because it was extraordinary power. So if trees they're 100 foot tall or whatever, right? So they just fall over like dominoes, one after the other. Mm-hmm. And that in itself is not so bad. It does create difficulty harvesting it, and it's slower, and it's, less value and all that sort of stuff. But this storm was extraordinary because a significant number of the trees actually just broke off 20 foot, 30 foot up. Snapped off like matches.
Oh my God.
Which means it's kind of valueless, or significantly less value because the harvester, you come in, and it's computerized harvester, so you come in and you take the cutter to the bottom and it'll say, it'll measure the diameter of the tree and it'll say, to maximise the value of this, this diameter, we'll cut that in a 16-foot, 12-foot, 14-foot for construction timber or this, that and the other. And they'll work their way through the tree.
But when they're snapped in two, that's no good to you.
Snapped in two and now you lose, I don't know what percentage.
So how much of your, what did you say, 50 acres, how much survived, you know, made it through the storm?
I don't know yet. I can't actually get through it. I'm actually waiting for a drone to come and survey it.
Well, what's your sense of it? I'm sure you've been down on
My sense of it is it's depressing. Extremely depressing.
More than half of it gone, do you think?
I'd say probably so.
Yeah.
And it's. I suppose what's really galling about it is, from being a farmer in the modern world, it's not a good profession to be in, put it that way, with all the negativity in relation to farming and climate change, and we seem to be responsible for everything. Mm-hmm. But I planted that forestry, right, and I've taken all the risk. And in a sense, I've taken all that risk for the common good, because, every day you pick up the paper or whatever, there's someone sitting behind the desk telling farmers what they should plant, how they should plant it, how they should do their business. Everyone earning a wage, a weekly wage, and they're telling us how to do things. Mm-hmm. And I've minded this for 35 years. All these people are telling me I should plant forestry. Well, where are they today? There's no one going to compensate me. I've lost a six-figure sum in relation to this.
Yeah.
And Katie, when I clear fell it, I have to go and replant it again, legally, without any financial support.
Oh, that's the deal, is it? Once you fell it, you have to replace.
That's it. So you legally have to, trying to replant it again is much more difficult than planting it the first time because of disease, risk and whatever. So in essence, what I'm doing is I'm handing on 50 acres of a burden to my children. And the land is devalued. I'm just giving it to the state, really. It's just for the common good. I'm going to plant that land again for the common good. And I now have to plant 30% of my next crop is going to be a hardwood, which is valueless, in essence. I'm giving away 30% of my land, so it really is a burden, And anyone who thinks about forestry, they want to have their head examined going forward. It just doesn't make sense. Financial sense, emotional sense, risk.
But climate sense, it really makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, there's no better thing to be doing with land in terms of, as you say, they're creating carbon sinks than planting trees.
Okay, well, if you believe that as a taxpayer, are you prepared to support landowners and share the risk?
Well, this is the question, isn't it?
Are they prepared to share the risk going forward? Because it's not just that now, Katie. There's ash dieback has wiped out people who planted ash. And you know what ash dieback is, it's killed their trees. Yeah. And they've been left high and dry. Their pensions are gone. They're still stuck with land. The last minister for agriculture and junior minister were absolutely disastrous in relation to forestry. I mean, forestry has collapsed, really.
Well, I know there was huge issues, wasn't there, about even, getting licences for felling and all of that. There was
Huge. But if you take the long-term view, if you want forestry, then you're going to have to pay people to plant it because the risks are enormous. There's beetles now, there's ash dieback. And it's a scandal that's never actually been investigated, how ash dieback came into Ireland and we're an island. And now there's bark beetle coming in, as we found in Clare. So there's all these risks in an island. We shouldn't be allowing these things in, and we are. It's just a complete dereliction of duty.
Go back to the wind for 1 minute. Are you okay there in terms of power and water and all that?
Well, the power's gone. Came back last night. Gone again today. But I presume it'll go back again. I'm assuming it'll go back again.
Sorry to interrupt you, but did you have power lines running through that forestry?
No, not mine.
Because
there is a stipulation if you have that you have to keep a clear way through to 20 metres.
20 metres on either side.
20 metres on, if you have a three-phase power on either side. Well, no, 20 metres in total, but that seems to me to be inadequate because a tree will grow.
Well, I was just going to say, if you have a 100-metre tree, sure, that's no good to you.
Yeah, but then I suppose it comes back to loss then. If you have to, you're giving away all that and you get no compensation for it. But there is a stipulation, and some of them are new, actually. They've been updated. You can't now plant close to a road. It used to be in the past.
I would love to hear more about this, actually. Exactly what are the regulations around these poles and where they can go and what can be beside them? Because clearly there is questions now about how close to trees a lot of these poles have been placed, you know, which came first, the trees or the poles. And now a new question today. We must find out more about that, about whether or not
you'll find, Katie, that a lot of the trees, a lot of the lines that are down are where lines just follow roads, minor roads, county roads or whatever. And you have your ash trees and your ash to rotten or whatever. And they're falling down. And you have the poles that haven't been maintained. They're rotten and they're falling down. So it's a lot of maintenance. It seems to me that we haven't invested in our infrastructure. And, I mean, there's people there and they have no fire. They can't burn their turf. They have no timber. They have no gas. And they're completely dependent on electricity. And if we don't invest in our infrastructure, electrical infrastructure, I don't know where we're going, because people are 100% dependent on it. Why not? I've got a fire here. I've got a little bit of gas burner reserve. But no power, no water there for a few days, you know.
Indeed, and as I say, it's more dependent on electricity infrastructure we're getting rather than less, you know, because of going...
Absolutely, won't even go near data centres, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly, Frank. Another day's work. I'm sorry for your loss there. That's a tough one.
Can I just say, Katie, before I go, like, I'm talking about financial loss or whatever, but I'm very conscious of that young man who got killed, Capper, Dudek in Rafoe, kind of, I'm very conscious of that, and I would like to say that that is much more significant than my loss, and I'd like to commiserate with that family.
Absolutely, and we have to remember that we were incredibly lucky, and not just lucky, because we got the warnings that we to stay, you know, shelter in place, as we were told, and I do think that probably did save lives on the night of the storm itself.
It absolutely did.
And we should acknowledge that.
And we should also acknowledge that, you know, without the GAA clubs, the rugby clubs, the soccer clubs, the community centres that are open around my area, you know, and the farmers going around cutting trees, moving trees or whatever, that the whole place would be a standstill.
Absolutely, Frank.
Thank them for that.
Thank you for that. And I just want to bring in, before we go to the break, Antoinette. Antoinette, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie.
You were making a similar point to the one that Frank was just making there, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I'm listening to the show there and I'm hearing about a lot of stories about the electricity and different things. But I was just, maybe could we take note and for people to be aware that maybe there's another element of people suffering as well in the weather, with especially if you're under palliative care at home. And you rely on power and there is no power. And then you rely on maybe the army and the civil defence trying to help somebody. Because I was in a similar situation there after Christmas in January with my husband now, who actually has passed away. But we had a lot of snow and the electricity went, I think it was about 3.5-4 days. And eventually the water went as well, but that wasn't for too long. But, you know, we had to really manage with nothing, and it's just another layer that people might consider as well. You know, it is terrible. People are losing a lot in the electricity issue or no power, but when you're palliative at home, there's another layer added on altogether, you know.
Oh my God, Antoinette, I'm so sorry. That's very, very recent loss for you.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it
and
is.
That must but have I've, been I've, just so, so hard, as you say, when you're you're in that situation, and you know you're so vulnerable,
and the Cancer Society, we had nurses at night, but only for the civil defence and the army. They wouldn't have been able to get to the house because we live in a rural area, and family members and neighbours got together and found a generator somewhere to try and get some electricity, because my husband, one of the biggest fears we had was because of his temperature, we needed a fan. So that was very actually frightening that we mightn't be able to use the fan, but somebody managed to find batteries somewhere, but people had to walk. Even the priests had to park a car far away and walk to the house because it was so bad. But the electricity, there was no lights, there was nothing. So we relied on an open fire and we relied on putting the phones in the car to charge them, to have light from those as well. So it was very difficult. And we were perished with cold. But it's just something else. It's another thing, you know. It's another layer that that has to be considered. Now, we did ring the electric company, the ESB, at the time, thinking we could get medical, you know, urgency to get the electricity back on, but we hadn't registered with them, so that wasn't a possibility. But to be fair, the ESB were very informative, and we got updates very regularly. So we relied on them, and they never gave us a date too soon or a time, I have to say, to be fair. So, you know.
Oh, and I'm sure they're. I'm sure they were very conscious of your situation as well. You know, when you would explain it.
Yeah.
And you you've three teenage sons, is it?
Oh, I do have three teenage lads. Yeah. Which were very good, really, because they had a lot of just bringing in buckets of coal and everything to try and keep an open fire going. But I've one lad with special needs and that. But we were lucky enough; he's not on anything electrical. Do you know?
Yeah.
But and the pumps that my husband eventually were on from the hospice were worked on battery, and they had left us spare batteries as well. So we were really as prepared as we could be.
Yeah.
But having no electricity was devastating, really. We just couldn't believe it. You know?
Well, and Antoinette, that's really talk. Yeah, that's very much perspective, I think, for a lot of us. You had an awful lot on your plate there. So, you know, condolences on your loss.
Power, thank you. But just that the power affects so many people in so many different ways. And I know we're down in County Limerick and the West is getting the worst of it.
Mm-hmm.
But we got the worst of it in the first week of January as well, where we had no electricity for up to 4 days, you know.
Yeah, and I know there is some people in that in that end of the country who was hit by the snow and is now dealing again with, because we spoke to somebody yesterday, dealing again with this power outage. So
absolutely.
That does chip away at you as well.
And we did, we know people who actually put, because the snow now was the biggest day, who we were at, we put milk in that in the snow outside to keep it fresh.
At least you had a natural freezer,
We had a natural freezer, but it was tough, and it's amazing how you can adapt, you know. Now, we were lucky the water was only gone for a period of time, so we were very lucky that way. But when my husband passed away, would you believe it, the electricity came back within an hour. So he did that, I think. But and just to be aware of that as well, you know.
Thank you, Antoinette. Thank you for that.
You're more than welcome. All right.
Take care.
No problem. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're going to move on for a moment now away from the weather stories and the predicament people are in, because I wanted to talk to some of our listeners about the story that we saw on the front page of the Irish Examiner today. It tells us that the incoming Minister for Defence, and that is our Taoiseach Simon Harris, any minister who comes into a new department like that gets a briefing from their officials. And the Examiner have had a peek at this briefing, and we're told that Simon Harris has been warned that many of Ireland's EU partners are, this is a quote, in full war preparation mode. And that given this changes in the geopolitics, as they say, that there will be a lower tolerance of our neutrality position in Ireland, here in Ireland. That this was something that was flagged to the incoming minister to be aware of. Brian Sheridan. Brian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Yeah. What do you think of that?
I'm not a bit surprised at all at it, because this warmongering of all around Europe, you know, it really plays into the military-industrial complex of the great powers. And for Ireland, we'll never be a military power. Our big power is our soft power and our strength in neutrality and peacemaking. That's what I see our and to be spending money on armaments and interoperability with Europe. I think it's a terrible disgrace, and it goes against the promises made in the Lisbon and Nice treaties, etc. You know, that we and against our constitution in many ways, that all conflicts must be resolved peacefully all efforts made to resolve them peacefully.
Yeah, I think I don't think it is in the Constitution, though. I think, didn't we really realise that when we started debating about it seriously, that actually if you wanted to ensure that neutrality was in the Constitution, that we'd have to have a referendum for it?
Well, there is an article in the Constitution, I can't remember, I think it's Article 26, stating that we preference is to resolve all conflicts peacefully, yeah, and make every effort to do that. So we should be pro-peace, actively pro-peace, rather than playing along with the big boys in Europe and get intoxicated by them and the military-industrial complex, which Micheál Martin has been doing. Incredible. He wants to remove the triple lock, which was promised to us, or that the UN would be...
But I suppose that what they're saying about that, isn't it that we are beholden to Russia, basically, in terms of the triple lock, because of needing the UN to okay any deployment of our troops in peacekeeping.
Yes, in theory, that's what they're saying. But is this a time to be undermining the United Nations? Is this a time? And now the United Nations is undermining Ireland's neutrality. It's absolutely farcical in that respect. You know? And we have a great reputation worldwide for our soft power. And that's where our strength is, our soft power. Around the world, we're recognised for it. And we'll never be a military. And our biggest threat to security is, as we know at the moment, climate change. And that's where our money should be spent. And money should be spent on defence, climate change, and cyber. And also, I think, our military should be the best negotiators, best mediators, the best trained people when they go abroad to do us proud, which they have done, and be really well paid. Do we want our grandsons going to fight in European battle groups? Do you? Would you like your grandchildren or your children to fight in European battle groups? That's what we're headed to.
What do you say to people who say we're freeloaders, and that's what the way people are looking at us now, that we are not able to even defend our neutrality, that we don't have a navy to send out on our boats, we don't have, our army strength is you know, falling down. What is it now? 6,089 in the army in 2024. That's nearly 900 less than it was 5 years ago.
OK, I would say we are making a contribution. We're our peacekeepers. Is that not worth anything in the world? If everybody is armed in the world, where do you go to discuss peace? That's one element of it. Uh-huh. You know, so we are making a huge contribution to peace, and that should be our strength.
Will you hang on there, Brian? I want to bring in Stephen. Stephen, good afternoon.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Katie.
Yeah, where do you stand on this?
Well, I prefer to deal in facts rather than scaremongering. And I do remember, I think in 2023, I attended the government's consult forum on international security policy.
Oh, yeah, that was a very controversial forum, as I recall. A lot of people refusing to turn up at it and all that.
Well, I thought it was useful because we need to have an adult debate about these things. And one statistic stuck in my mind, which I think is still relevant considering what was just said there, in that Norway is a member of NATO, but they've participated in over 50 UN peacekeeping missions. Membership of a military alliance doesn't stop a country being engaging in UN activities such as peacekeeping. And I think I think what was said in the paper is absolutely true. It's like your neighbour coming over to you continuously to borrow your car or borrow your lawnmower. I mean, Ireland spends 0.2, that's one-fifth of 1% of GDP on defence, while the average for the rest of the EU is 1.3. So we can't have it both ways.
So we're the lowest, aren't we, Stephen? We spend the very least of any country in Europe.
Yeah, and we don't have proper primary defence. Radar. We see all the problems with the Navy not having the crew or the equipment for the ships. I think we absolutely need to spend some money on both capital and also properly resourcing our defence forces. I think we should pay them more. I mean, the world we live in now is rather different to maybe the world of the 40s, 50s or even the 80s, in that we face a number of security threats. I mean, we shouldn't forget that when the HSE was struck by the Wizard Spider Group, which has links to the Russian FSB, the state security, with the cyber attack, that greatly crippled our HSE and probably cost people's lives. We can't ignore that. But I also think it's very relevant the fact that so many of the internet cables, the fibre cables that connect Europe to the States and also help all the companies that employ people here, runs by our coast, and we have no way of defending it. I think we should have a proper conversation. I personally would have no problem with Ireland joining NATO, but I don't think that will happen.
You'd actually go all the way to joining NATO, would you?
I'd have no problem with that. I think we need to look at our national security and defence. We need to look at our infrastructure. We particularly need to look at cybersecurity. Plus, the other thing is, there's a lot of misinformation going around. I mean, 23 out of 27 of the EU nations are already members of NATO. Plus, it wouldn't necessarily impact our participation in other things, in that Sweden and Finland, who recently joined NATO, they maintain their independent foreign policies. There's no requirement for them to host bases or engage in any combat. There'd be no such thing as conscription. That's just scaremongering.
But would it not just put a target on our back, though, if we were full-in NATO members?
I think quite the reverse. There's Article 5, which guarantees mutual defence. We already are subject to attack. We have been attacked in terms of cybersecurity. Whether it's bad actors or whether it's criminals, they view Ireland as a very soft touch. Our west coast is greatly unprotected. It's the frontier between ourselves and the Atlantic Ocean and the States, and we simply do not have the equipment. So I think we either need to look at increasing spending substantially, or if there's no will to spend the money, we should look at joining other countries who will assist us.
Okay, well, I mean,
Stephen, who's going to attack us? Are our neighbours going to attack us, Stephen? Are the neighbours?
We already have been attacked with cyber attacks.
I agree with you. I agree with you, Stephen, about cyber security. Absolutely, I agree with you on that. And the biggest threat is climate change, you know. And you honestly think we should spend vast amounts of money, of taxpayers' money, on armaments and missiles and tanks when we are a neutral, and we are the only country in the EU that was not a colony. And we should be different, and we should use that difference with strength and proactivity, not by running. We're only 1 or 2% of the EU and spending millions of taxpayers' money when there's so many other things, as we know now, that we're not prepared for. And we're going to get more and more of these storms and more cyber attacks. I agree with you on that. And the undersea cables, that is a bit of a red herring, because the one that was attacked in the middle of NATO, that was encouraged by the CIA, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and the.
Oh, come
Times
on! That's conspiracy nonsense. There is absolutely no proof
you're,
of that.
No, you're buying into the narrative. You're creating a narrative.
You're watching too much Fuel Tube. You need to look at the reality, I'm afraid.
But that's my whole point.
By joining a defence, whether.
Okay, Stephen. First of all, Brian, I don't have any evidence for that theory about that being an inside job or whatever. But hang on there, on, Stephen. Hang on, the two of you, because I do need to take a break. But we will come back to both of you after this. Just hang
Talk
on.
To Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we're talking there about neutrality, whether it is an idea whose time may be past or may be in question. Stephen, I cut you off there.
Yeah, thanks, Edie. No, it's just to answer the gentleman there who's talking about spending vast amounts of money. But that's also my point. Membership of NATO or maybe an EU defence pact would provide us with access to collective air defence and also sea defence without us investing money ourselves.
Yeah, but sorry, Stephen, there are very basic rules in NATO that you have to contribute a certain amount of your GDP, isn't there? I mean, and it's quite a considerable distance from where we're at the minute.
Well, I have no problem with us going to the EU average. I mean, other neutral states around Europe. The Swiss have a decent air force and army. Ireland doesn't. We can't keep relying on everyone else and making a phone call to the French or the British and say that, can you give us a dig out all the time?
It's a very expensive business, Stephen. Very expensive.
Well, we have, I think, the once off of the $13 billion from Apple. I know we're going to invest that in infrastructure. And I certainly think a good use of that will be primary radar. We can't identify what's even flying over the country. The reality is Irish air defence is really nothing more than harsh language at the moment. We can't defend ourselves. And I think it's time to have a proper adult discussion about it. And maybe you have the resources. And the other key point I think to make is at the moment it looks like the US may be pulling back from NATO. So if NATO is going to restructure, maybe now is the time to discuss it with them, or at the very least with their EU partners.
OK, hang on there, Stephen. Gerry Hanley. Gerry, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. I'm coming at this discussion from a slightly different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on the basis that conscription is an evil. It's just a view I've always had, and particularly now as I'm a grandfather of, you know, a number of children under seven. And my generation, many of us, were here because our parents and grandparents, grandfathers generally, couldn't have been conscripted in the Second World War. So the whole idea of a future generation, that's the being conscripted or open to conscription, is just completely negative, non-runner for me. I mean, we might be also in a new world order, because if we just look at the bigger picture, Ireland, when we became a state, we joined the UN, the League of Nations, you know, to get away maybe from being conscripted to the British Army. Now we're back just talking about a relatively small area of Europe in the world. And there's a new world order. Can I just mention that the US has said they're not going to go to war. China hasn't invaded any place in 100 years.
Yeah, well, has anyone been talking to Mr. Putin lately, though?
Not, you know, they're saying that that's going to be part of a process. Lots of people have said the Americans are at fault. They have a bit of make-up to do there. They didn't comply with the Minsk agreement. That's, you know, that's kind of a long way away from us. We are already protected. Just to make a point relative to a previous speaker, the UK Air Corps protects Irish base under contract. It, in fact, has escorted Russian spy jets out of here. They're well documented. So we have sources of protection. And I want to strengthen that idea of us having an independent voice in the world. You know, there's need. Every action starts with a thought. And if people don't start talking peace...
But is there any... Can I ask you, Gerry? And I'm open to persuading on any of these points, but is there any point at which it becomes morally unsustainable not to pick a side? If a friendly country, a country that looks on us as a friend, gets invaded, and is it okay for us that in all circumstances to say, tough, we're not going to take a side on that because we're afraid of what might happen to us if we lose.
My answer to that, Katie, is it is morally wrong to pay people to kill other people, bottom line. You know, and that has to stop somewhere along the line, because what's happening is you're getting chunks of money sent to Eastern Europe from the States for people to kill each other.
But what about when you get invaded, though? What who protects the country that's invaded,
you know,
and the people
What about when a nuclear missile goes off? What about when we're hit from a missile from Mars or from outer space? You know, let's deal with the real now. And I do think that there's a new world order. I mean, our our own president was speaking about this maybe 2 years ago, to get negotiations started before more killing between Ukraine and Russia. And that's what's going to happen eventually. They're going to have to talk to stop the killing. And I worry when politicians start to push the idea. I remember Mr. Varadkar, who came back there from some EU meeting 2 years ago, and, you know, spoke about upping our spend and all that. The upshot of all of that is the only thing Europe will need from us is our men and women in future armies. And I think the earlier we face up to that and put a stop to that, the better. And on the political level, our politicians or whoever represents our president have a better voice. And especially if it's the only voice in Europe of a country advocating neutrality and peace.
And can I, and I'm literally just throwing this out there on devil's advocate. I mean, you said, you know, you're here and other people, a lot of people are here because there wasn't conscription back during the Second World War. But you could say Europe only exists in the form that it does because people did go and fight for their future and for their country's futures. So that's the other side of that coin, isn't it?
Yes. And conscription for me is different to the idea of fighting to defend yourself. The idea of people, and I saw it firsthand in Vietnam when I came there as a tourist, you know, bring back when 1.25 million civilians get killed. You know, the idea of defending your country, that's one thing. The idea of grandchildren of ours or children being conscripted to a war or to go over to the eastern border of Europe as part of an army for things they know nothing about is evil. And somewhere between here and there, there has to be some balance. But it's not about us. Just because Finland and Sweden or other countries make a move, somebody prompts some of our politicians, we don't have to be just like everybody else, because being like everybody else is in for war. It's not where we want to go.
Okay, Gerry, thank you. Yeah, hang on there. Thank you. I have a Gerard now. Gerard, good afternoon.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, you're listening to Gerry there.
I am indeed, yeah. I don't know who your second speaker was, but I would certainly agree with him about...
That was Stephen.
Stephen, is it? Yeah. Look, these arguments tend to get very emotional about our grandchildren and children and all this kind of thing going to war. The reality is we have to kind of, if we're part of today's world, we have to accept responsibility for the defence of the places we're involved in. We happen to be members of Europe economically and more or less, not to my particular liking, but politically almost as well. Therefore, we have to be part of the defence of Europe. I mean, if you look at it historically, we were neutral on two occasions. World War One, which I certainly agree with, it was for a particular reason because we were more or less at war with one of the belligerents ourselves. But World War Two, we were neutral, but we were neutral in favour of the Allies. We sent Allied who had crashed over Ireland. We sent them back across the border to re-enter the war. Mm-hmm. We locked up the Germans in the Curra, and we facilitated the Northern Corridor to allow Allied planes to go out over the Atlantic. So why are we neutral? It's debatable.
But I think, Gerard, that we are still neutral on the side of the good in Eastern Europe, because we are supporting the American position. People are saying Shannon is being used. We've sent a lot of vehicles and whatever else and people to train soldiers to Eastern Europe. In fact, the Russian ambassador said he was actually seeing it as an act of war on Ireland's behalf. So we can still be neutral on the right side, if you know what I mean.
So you're okay with an elastic definition of neutrality then, Gerry?
I go back to my premise, which is that, paying people to kill other people is just not morally right. And anything other than that, I'd be as elastic as you need to be.
Okay, you're very stretchy. Gerard, will you hang on to that thought for me, please? I have to take another break, but we'll be back to you in 1 minute. Thank you.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we are debating neutrality and our position on it. Gerard, I cut you off there.
No bother, Katie, yeah. I think at the end of the day, really, when you look at it in the cold light of day, we must be prepared to defend whatever the situation might be, whether it's within the European army or as members of NATO. I don't have a problem with either, to be honest with you. But we can't be continuing to depend on other people. We're dependent on the RAF to give us top cover for various things. We must be able to and prepared to defend what the jurisdictions we live in, along with our neighbours, if we have to.
Gerard, can I just put you, though, and I think a point was made earlier. Like what we would need to, the kind of levels of investment we would need to get anywhere near, being able to take our own responsibility for our own security is eye-watering. So we are going to end up relying on the UK and NATO or NATO members, countries. Anyway, so, are we just kind of wanting to be up there with the boys and spend, our taxpayers' money on boys' toys ultimately, we are never going to be in a position to defend our skies or our seas?
No, you're correct in one way, Katie, but that's not really the point. The point is that we must be prepared to take part. In other words, we're a small country at the end of the day. We have a very small defence force, but we must be prepared to shoulder our alongside, serve alongside our counterparts. We can't be dependent on the French, the French or the Germans or the Italians or the Greek troops on to defend us. In other words, we must be, after all, during World War II, some 300,000 odd Irish men from the south served in the British Army and were badly treated actually afterwards here in this country. Looked like they were kind of traitors or whatever. But we have to be able to be part of, I'm not saying we were in a position to spend massive amounts on tanks and artillery and all that kind of stuff, but we must show cause, I think. Yeah. Katie, you know, I think that's the most important thing.
Okay, I want to get a woman's voice into this now if I can. Marion, do I have Marion there?
You do, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, where are you on this, Marion?
Katie, I'm just mesmerised. I'm listening there, and really the phrase comes to mind: if you want war, prepare for war. If you want peace, prepare for peace. And it sounds like we don't have a choice. We're preparing for war, and we're gathering arms, and we're forging alliances, and we're getting ready for war as if there wasn't an alternative. And there is. The alternative is peace and preparing for peace. And nobody is talking about preparing for peace. Preparing for war is massively expensive. It's harmful to the environment. It wastes resources that could be spent elsewhere. Look at our electricity. We haven't even the facilities to prepare to repair our electricity after a storm without going weeks and weeks. So we need to start thinking about the alternative to war.
Okay.
If we go
about
nuclear war.
Can I put to you, Marion, that that's all
yeah.
well and good if everyone is on the same page?
Yeah.
But clearly, while most of Europe would be happy with the peaceful route, we have Putin, who was prepared to invade
yeah.
Ukraine, and you know
yeah.
if Ukraine wasn't standing in the way, where else would those troops end up?
I think that's oversimplification, and Putin is being trotted out like the devil on horseback every time you mention peace or neutrality or making friends with people. Putin is dragged out in front of us as if he's some kind of the ultimate evil in the world. There's a history to the war in Ukraine. Nobody talks about that. Nobody tells us about it. There is a history to the war in Ukraine. You've got to look at the war in Ukraine in context. We know that Putin offered peace talks 2 weeks into that war, and peace talks were turned down at the behest of the British and the Americans. There's a big, long, complicated history there to the war in Ukraine. And I don't think it's fair to use that one war to justify arming the earth to the teeth with deadly weapons. If we have
we
will be destroyed.
Can I just put
There's
you,
no
though, because
back.
If you talk to people, it's all very well us out on the other side, a good safe distance
yeah.
away from the borders where that war is raging right now, to have notions about what might be in Putin's head. But if you are, if you talk to anybody from Lithuania, from Finland, from any of the Baltic countries there, they have a completely different view on this, because they're not long out. They're in their living memory, just one
yeah.
generation away. They
yeah.
had Russia inside their borders, and they've
mm-hmm.
managed to
mm-hmm.
escape from that. And they have a very, very different view about what Putin might have in his
mm-hmm.
in his plan.
Yes, of course, they're coming at it from their own perspective and from their own geographical position. And that doesn't, we're not involved in that end of it. But in the end of the day, even if Russia went to war with Sweden or Finland, at some point, all wars, if we don't annihilate each other, which we very likely will, but if we don't, at some point, all wars must come to talks and a rearrangement of the world after the war. And we will need peacekeepers, and we will need negotiators, and we will need arbitrators in those circumstances. And who better than a neutral country like ours, who has never been involved in a war with any of these countries? We haven't taken sides. We haven't attacked anybody. We are ideally placed to be the peacekeepers, the arbitrators and the negotiators, absolutely in line with Article 29 of our Constitution.
Okay, Marion, will you hang on? I need to take my last break. I will be back to this after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we just have a few minutes left. I can squeeze in Una. Una, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
Good. What do you make of what Marion was saying there?
I was just saying, wouldn't it be a great world if we all lived in peace, like John Lennon's favourite song. But unfortunately, human beings and nature is not like that. And she's very naive to think that Putin is a man you could talk to. Putin is the last person on earth you could make sense with, because he's a despot, you know, and he's has to be curtailed in every way we can and help. And on relation to Ireland being neutral, I think that's a cop out. We want all the help we can get, but we don't want to be members. It's like being a member of a club, but yet not pay the subscription.
Right. Okay, Carl.
Yes, hello.
What do you think?
Well, I think that neutrality is gone. I think we have to make a stand, but I think that doesn't mean we cannot be peacekeepers. Now, I, as a child, was with relatives after the Nazis left Jersey. And I'll never forget the stories of that. And there's many times here, I live in County Wexford, there's many times here I imagine that, or I have in my head what they went through, and imagine if we were invaded the west of Ireland. Those ships weren't cruising from Russia on the west coast. They were on a recce. And I can't understand why the government cannot see that we need to invest in our armies and things like that. You know, it's just crazy the way the world has got. I mean, peace, as that other lady said, you know, those days are gone. Those days are really gone, the way the world is now. We have to be protected.
What about the idea that we can't afford the levels of investment that we would need to actually protect ourselves? So we will always be dependent on, more well-resourced neighbours.
As there are many other countries too, but we can't just sit and do nothing. I mean, there has to be something we can do on a smaller scale, you know?
Yeah.
There must be something. It makes me frightened to think that there's nobody can do anything. And as soon as we start helping ourselves,
Una,
other people will help.
Yeah. Una, we'll come back to this one because there's a lot of interest in it and a lot of calls. Absolutely.
Thank you for hearing this, because it's important. You know?
Thank you, Una, and thank you, Carl, and thanks to all our callers today. Best of luck to everyone out there still waiting for their power to come back. But we're out of time. On sound today was Paul Murnoch. Research was Audrey Dunhu. Broadcast coordinator today was Shane Galvin, and today's programme was produced by Annette Egan. We'll stand by now for Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Home in on end-of-season savings on bedding, curtains, wallpapers and more. In-store and online at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.